Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. We're continuing our series of voter roundtables today. Every week until the election, we're hosting conversations between voters about the issues that matter most to them and what they want for this country for the next 4 years. We've talked with ardent supporters of Donald Trump and Joe Biden over the past couple of weeks. Today, we're going to hear from a cross-section of voters from a state that both campaigns feel is a must-win for them, Wisconsin.
Probably the top issues in my mind for this fall are Trump's mismanagement of the COVID-19 crisis and his lack of recognition of the problem with race relations in this country.
I just feel that there is such a difference between the parties right now, and I don't identify, and I just vote for balance.
What we need is a leader who can unite us and help us heal. We need healing.
That was Andrea from Madison, Wisconsin, Ken from Dodgeville, and Bob from Waukesha, who called us to share their perspectives. Well, let's hear from three more Wisconsin voters. Joining us now from Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, is Cassie Menawa. Menawa. Did I get that right, Cassie?
Yeah, it's Menawa.
Okay, I'm so sorry for mispronouncing it. I promise you I'll get it right for the rest of the show.
Sounds good.
Cassie is an assistant manager at Black Point at the State Museum, and she graduated from Carthage College in Kenosha just last year. So welcome to the show, Cassie.
Thank you.
Randy Schmidt joins us from Gotham, Wisconsin. He's a dairy farmer. Randy, great to have you.
Thank you. Hello, Meghna.
And also with us from Green Bay is Alexis Arnold. She's a gallery and gift shop owner. Alexis, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so how we've tended to start these conversations is just kind of a quick roundtable of, if you were to cast your vote today, who would you vote for? So let me just kind of get a tally here. Cassie, let me start with you. If you had to send in your ballot today, who would get that check mark?
If I sent in my ballot today, I would be voting for Joe Biden.
Okay. And you want to just quickly tell me why?
He wasn't initially, my ideal candidate. But I think compared to Donald Trump, he just represents more ideals that I can get behind, especially like in terms of, racial inequality, the environment, healthcare.
Okay. And Randy, what about you? If you had to vote today, who would you vote for?
Well, there hasn't been a lot of, we haven't really heard a lot of rhetoric from, there haven't been debates between the two candidates or anything yet. And right now, I would say I voted Trump for the last election. And as a dairy farmer and producer, I will probably still stay with Trump because of the trade policies and other things.
Okay, so agriculture and trade are really big issues in Wisconsin, and we'll talk more about that a little later in the show, I promise, because I want to hear all of your perspectives on that. So thank you for that, Randy. And Alexis, what about you? Who would you vote for if you cast your ballot today?
Yeah, that's a really hard question. I'm that undecided voter at the moment, and honestly, if it was today, I don't know if I would have a clear decision, of one or the other. Nobody's really standing out to me.
Okay, so tell me more. Why is that? What haven't you seen yet that would help you make up your mind?
Well, I think what Randy said, too, we haven't really seen any debates between the two. So I think that, definitely stands out, where it just feels really disconnected. I mean, obviously on all levels of what's happening in society, but between the two of them as well. We haven't really had the chance, I think, to hear... I haven't heard enough policies of like what change is really going to happen or what they're going to implement, I guess, especially on Biden's side.
Okay. Well, so tell me then, I hear what you're saying about not having heard enough of policy. I guess it depends on how much time people have to pay attention.
Yeah, exactly.
Because those of us who are in the thick of it all the time think we've had like more than a year, but people are living their real lives. So I get your point here. But thus far, given what you know, what do you think What do you see as the differences between Donald Trump and Joe Biden?
Well, I mean, I think what Randy said, I like seeing and hearing that Trump is helping small business owners. Obviously, I'm from Wisconsin, so with the agriculture, I know that's huge for our area. And I'm sure Randy can get into it more. The little I know about it is that there was a time where a lot of farms were at risk of going under, and that's major for our state. So, you know, and I'm a small business owner too, entrepreneur. Yeah. So for me, I want to see things that are going to help the small business owner succeed, that instead of bringing us down.
Okay. Randy, go ahead, Randy. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Ask the question.
Oh, no. I was actually just going to jump to Cassie here. But you know what? Mick, the three of you talk with each other. That's perfectly fine.
Well,
so go ahead.
No, as a small business owner and a farmer, you know, we've seen this crisis. We've seen our supply chains interrupted. We've seen, I mean, in Wisconsin here, the store shelves were empty of milk. How can that happen in the dairy state? and we had to speed up, and yet, you know, we met that. And it's just been a moving target. You know, when one sector closes down, another's, you have to, you know, we're kind of by the seat of our pants right now as an industry to keep moving and keep the supply chains, keep the food. And that's what we do. We produce food, and then it trickles up to through the other workers and through the production. They make cheese. I mean, most of our milk goes for cheese, and they've had to change their product mix to adapt to, you know, having a 50% go to the restaurant food into, you know, that type of industry, back to just people drinking milk, buying more cheese. People are eating more, you know, making more of their meals at home. So it's everything's changed in the last 6 months.
In the last 6 months. Okay. So Cassie, what do you think about that?
Yeah. So I guess I have a question for Randy or Alexis. I'm not, you know, a small business owner. I don't really know much about agriculture, but I'm interested to see, obviously the coronavirus pandemic kind of threw everything off for a lot of people, but I'm interested to like hear, before the pandemic, what do you think the Trump administration specifically was doing to help small businesses and, you know, agriculture?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm fairly new. I just recently took over an art gallery in downtown De Pere, Wisconsin. And so it was already there for maybe about a year and a half. It was in the process of growing. And I received the keys on November 1st of 2019. So I didn't really have it for very long before I did have to shut down. And that was really hard, obviously, because I wasn't essential. But you know, as a small business owner, you want to do what's right for your community. So I guess I don't, as far as, you know, coming into the new business and just kind of getting it up and running and trying to get it to grow, you know, we just came to kind of that halt. And it was a mess. It's like nobody really knew what was going on. You know, it was changing literally by the hour. And it's like, can we be open? Can we not be open? And it was really stressful there for a little bit. And then I just kind of learned, you know what, we just got to go with the flow and not stress about it, and we'll come out of it.
I think, you know, your business, we had, you know, all of a sudden we became essential workers, or we had essential businesses. And we're right on the ground floor of an essential business. So that's one thing. But I think we were talking about before, so let's go back. Before, I mean, we've reworked like NAFTA, the trade policies. I think maybe there's some improvements in there. You have to remember, as a dairy producer, our main trading partner really is Mexico. A majority of ours actually is Mexico, Canada, and then of course the rest of the world. China being also a major player, and China's always, you know, they weigh in on everything.
So, Randy, can I ask you about that? Because I was just wondering, when the president, soon after he took office, I mean, he really went hard after China on trade, right? There was essentially a trade war going on. And
We're still feeling that.
So I was going to ask you, because farmers got hit really hard because the exports to China dropped way off. But go ahead.
We're not only producers, we're consumers. I mean, a lot of our supplies come from China, and, you know, just say for your, for instance, your fans, for your ventilation, for your buildings and everything, for your livestock, there's tariffs put on there. I mean, our cost, you know, when that trade war went in, it raised some of our cost, and, but hopefully it makes, you know, so we're trading, you know, free, so we're free trading instead of, you know, manipulative trading. And I think that's what we, you know, really have to focus on.
So can I just ask you one more quick question, Randy, since we're talking so much about agriculture? I'm seeing here that ultimately China did agree to buy some $200 billion worth of U.S. goods, including
20 billion. Total goods.
Okay, yeah. And then I was going to say, at least I'm seeing around 30 billion of agricultural products this year. But because of the pandemic and reduced global trade, that hasn't quite yet happened. So, you know, there were developments on the trade relationships between the U.S. and China, specifically around agriculture. But do you think, I mean, did you have to do a lot of belt tightening because of the trade war that did take place? And I'm wondering if you think that the president's methodology was the right one, because I know a lot of farmers did suffer for a couple of years at least, and maybe are still suffering.
Well, as I said, for dairy, you know, China is important because it just represents such a huge market for us. And a 1 or 2% difference in our total, you know, when you look at the whole milk production in the United States, a 1 or 2% shortage, you know, if it's being traded out and we're doing more trade, I think, you know, with Trump, over 20% of our product has moved over, you know, been exported, and that is important.
Okay. Well, Randy Schmidt and Cassie Menonaugh and Alexis Arnold, stand by it for just a moment. There's a lot more about Wisconsin and about the nation that we want to hear from all three of you about. So we are talking today with Wisconsin voters about who they might cast their ballot for and what they want for this country over the next 4 years. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are listening to voters from Wisconsin today. It's the latest in our series of voter roundtables that we're holding every week between now and the election. I'm joined today by Randy Schmidt. He is a dairy farmer and is from Gotham, Wisconsin, likely voting for Donald Trump. Cassie Menonaugh joins us from Lake Geneva. She's assistant manager at Black Point Estate Museum in Lake Geneva. She went to Carthage College in Kenosha. She is planning to vote for Joe Biden. And Alexis Arnold joins us from Green Bay. She's a gallery and gift shop owner and, as of yet, doesn't know how she's going to cast her vote. Now, we talked a lot about agriculture, which is a big issue in the state. In the previous segment, I want to shift gears a little bit here and focus in on the issue of race, because, of course, what has happened in Kenosha and the police shooting of Jacob Blake really put Wisconsin back at the center of the national discussion on police violence and race. And here's a little bit of sound of how the community has in Kenosha has reacted. Sounds of protesters in Kenosha. Now, Cassie, I'd love to hear from you about this. How have the recent events there, how have they had an impact on you or affected your vote?
Yeah, having gone to school in Kenosha for, you know, the past 4 years, it, you know, is kind of personal. Obviously, I have the privilege of not being affected by any of it directly because I'm no longer living in Kenosha. But, you know, seeing it locally, it does kind of put it in a different perspective. I think something that's interesting to me about the whole situation is that a lot of people seem to be asking, like, how can this happen in Wisconsin? You know, like, we've seen it happen in other places. How can it be in Wisconsin? But I think when you look at Wisconsin as, like, a whole, Wisconsin has a lot of issues with race. It's one of the worst states for in terms of racial inequality and disparities, especially in education. And I think that's something that needs to be, you know, talked about more, especially coming into the election.
Tell me more. Why do you want it to be talked about more? Go ahead.
I want it to be talked about more because, you know, it obviously, it affects us all. And if we look at, you know, the systemic inequalities that are present in, you know, the fabric of our nation in every sector of, you know, society, we can kind of understand these things a little better, I think, and why they happen. I know both President Trump and Vice President Biden, they both have visited Kenosha, you know, within the past couple of weeks, and they took very different stances. You know, I think Joe Biden's approach was more to listen to the community and kind of hear what they had to say. And I really, you know, I like to see that kind of leadership where he sits down, he listens to the community that's actually, you know, suffering at the moment and hear what they have to say. So that was really appealing to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I want to invite all three of you to engage in conversation with each other. So, Randy or Alexis, what do you think? What have you seen in what has happened in Kenosha?
Well, I'm curious, before we kind of dig into that, Cassie, what it was like, you know, when you went to school there. Were you seeing issues during that time, and or do you feel like it just escalated, you know, with the shooting in the area?
Yeah, that's a good question. I went to, you know, Carthage College. It's right on the lake by Lake Michigan, and it's kind of a little separate from the rest of the city of Kenosha. So, like, personally, I didn't experience anything, you know, racially charged or anything like that. But there are incidents that happen, you know, all the time in, you know, many different cities, and, you know, Kenosha is not exempt from that.
Yeah.
Do you think that it, Cassie, that it escalated after, like, the National Guard was brought in, or before or after, or when, you know, they started, I mean, they came in and they started burning up the city. They burnt up car lots. I mean, I'd get up early in the morning and you'd be watching the news and see, you know, what they did the night before. And the same thing kind of happened in Madison. And I think that's one thing when we look at it, all of a sudden we're supposed to disarm all the police departments and everything else in the country. I mean, when you look at divisiveness, well, do we want a lawless society, or do we want just because of one incident, or there are a few incidents, but, you know, 99.9% of law enforcement is good. Do we let some bad acts once in a while just all of a sudden have to wholesale change everything?
Yeah, I think those are interesting points. And I think something that really I personally feel escalated the situation in Kenosha is the fact that, you know, these issues, like, especially with police brutality and, you know, racial violence, they have been in the national news since, you know, George Floyd was murdered. It's been in the national news for years, but, you know, we've really been focusing on it. And we've been seeing these protests and events throughout, you know, basically the whole timeline of the pandemic. And it's interesting to see, you know, at a time when the whole world is essentially aware and watching these, you know, protests and these events unfold, you know, there's a spotlight, and yet this still happens. You know, we still see excessive force, you know, used in broad daylight, caught on video. It's interesting to see that situation play out when it's already, you know, under a spotlight. So I think that, you know, kind of amplifies the reaction. And I think that's something that's, you know, confusing for a lot of people. Like, why is this still happening, even if we're all paying attention to it, you know? But I think the issue of, you know, the policing issue in general, I think that is, it's a hot topic for a lot of people. There's a lot of misinformation. Like, personally, I don't think...
Well, I just don't think we can let the actions of a, you know, a few... I mean, I you know, like, didn't just the whole police force basically in Rochester, New York resign the other day? I didn't really catch it all. But those kind of issues, I mean, we don't want to move into a lawless society also.
Right. I think something that's important, like, in this entire conversation about policing is kind of think about what we mean when we talk about reforming policing. We don't essentially, you know, want to disarm every police officer. But if we see, you know, if we consider some, you know, defunding, but divesting funds from, you know, the police departments and seeing that reallocated in different areas, such as education, we can kind of see a change happen, hopefully. So that's something I'm looking forward to see explored in, you know, the coming years. I know Joe Biden, he has this policy proposal with policing, and he wanted to invest in programs to prevent, you know, child abuse and improve literacy rates among children. And I think, you know, we could see, if we address these systemic issues, we can see them, you know, kind of play out in terms of crime rates, and then, you know, eventually see a change there.
Well, I'm just going to just step in here just for a second, just to provide a little bit of context, because Randy, you mentioned the Rochester, New York Police Department.
Right.
And I just wanted to just add a little bit something there in case people are wondering. But the police chief there and other high-ranking officers did resign because there's an ongoing inquiry into the death of Daniel Prude, who died in police custody after he was there's camera footage of him them using a spit hood while arresting him.
Okay.
And he had a hood. They put a hood over him and tried to subdue him. And he couldn't breathe, and he died later in the hospital, essentially in police custody. So there is an investigation going on into his death. And as that investigation is going on, there is a lot of community reaction. And the police chief and other high-ranking officers in the department have chosen to resign. But I think it's because they feel the criticism of them is is unfair right now.
Well,
go ahead.
Right. Well, Meghna, I'm rural America. That's really where I, you know, we're talking cities and everything. When I look at police enforcement, I mean, I'm very thankful. Locally, our police, you know, they handle disputes, domestic disputes, but, you know, we live where the population density isn't as great. And a lot of, you know, unfortunately, a lot of their duties also are just administering something like Narcan, because the issues around here are, you know, drug use and and meth and things like that. So every police force, and it is unique to probably their area that they're in, you know, so it's, we have to look at it quantitatively, but also we have to look at it, how it affects every area independently.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think kind of going, Cassie hit on talking about more education. I think just overall, I mean, obviously with our children, but I think there's like a serious lack of training when it comes to our police departments, like no matter where they are. I can't remember what they were saying, how long it takes what to go through the program, but it's short. It's, you know, like when you consider that job and what they do have to entail. I know that I don't I mean, think of putting yourself in that position and going out there and dealing with that stress, you know, kind of day in and day out. It'd be nice to see, instead of taking funds away from them, give them the support they need, you know, whether it's mental health, you know, like give them, you know, more time to just like decompress if they need to, because it is a very stressful job. And again, training, there's ways I think that they could, you know, educate them on how to disarm without weapons, you know, without tasers. But that takes a lot more time, you know, that's more hand-to-hand, you know, combat, understanding that and how you can subdue someone without actually, you know, bringing out your firearm or a taser.
Cassie, do you mind if I ask you, if you want to tell us a little bit more about you and your family, as Wisconsinites, and how, sort of your personal experience growing up there has informed how you view this country in 2020?
Yeah, I think personally, I've grown up in a smaller, you know, kind of vacation town, really centered on, you know, tourist economy and things like that. But for the most part, where I've grown up, it's not very diverse. You know, it's, you know, majority, I would say the majority of our city, you know, are leans towards being white. So I think going to school in Kenosha, even though it's still not the most diverse place ever, it was a lot more diverse. And I got to experience a totally different kind of setting that I had not experienced, you know, even just an hour, you know, west of where I went to school. So I think that's, you know, putting yourself in different, you know, environments, that's, you know, important. And it helps, I think it helps shape how you view the world, definitely.
Yeah. Well, I hope it's okay if I point this out, but your father is Black, right?
Yeah. So, well, my dad is, you know, he's mixed race. My mom is white. You know, growing up, a lot of people would, you know, ask me, you know, like, what are you, based off of, you know, me having, you know, a tanner complexion. So, you know, this definitely informs my, you know, my worldview. And even though, you know, my family, we've never really been, you know, what am I trying to say? We've never been in a situation in which, you know, we've been unsafe because of, you know, the way we've grown up, because of our, you know, racial heritage. But, you know, it's definitely something that shapes the way I see the world, for sure.
Can you tell me more about how it shapes it?
Well, I think having, you know, you see these things, you see other, you know, African-Americans being, you know, unfairly treated. And a lot of it is these systemic issues. And then growing up, you know, having, you know, a parent who is, you know, mixed race, but also has privilege because they pass as white a lot of the times. You know, I pass as white, and we're very privileged for that because, you know, we don't face a lot of discrimination that we otherwise would. But you are still, like, aware of the, you know, situations you could experience otherwise if you just looked a little different.
Hmm. Yeah.
Did you want to, did you, Randy, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Randy.
No, we are, you know, I mean, the United States is the original melting pot of, you know, different ethnic groups over the years and everything. And I think, you know, we just do have to have that diversity. You know, we have that diversity. We have to become more, I guess, user-friendly to everybody and more people. But I mean, we do live in, you know, in our rural area, I have, you know, it's predominantly white, but, you know, my kids mostly live in the cities, are around, you know, one lives in, you know, teaches in Racine, and, you know, he tells about the diverse pot, you know, there's just a lot of melting pots. So we have to figure out how we can all exist.
Mm-hmm. Alexis, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because when I was younger, I just really craved kind of that city life. So I just slowly moved west and I ended up in Portland, Oregon for about 15 years. And I just came back to the state of Wisconsin about 4 years ago. And you would think that living in a larger city would be more diverse, but ironically, it was not. There are pockets, you know, within the city, but, you know, Portland itself was a very white community, which I was kind of surprised. And then coming back to Green Bay, I mean, to me, Green Bay was almost like had more diversity, which I like being around that. I like, you know, I just like what it brings to a city, whether it's, you know, food, culture. Obviously, I'm heavy into the arts, so that's important as well. Oh. And so, yeah, it's just, it's interesting, you know, seeing, I think, like the racial tension, you know, popping up all over. Mm-hmm. And it's sad. I think, you know, we all, I mean, what, it's 2020 and it's like, you know, we can't right. get along at this point. It's just, I don't know. It just feels like we're kind of moving backwards well, in a lot of ways. So.
We've got to head into another quick break here, but I'm one of the big lessons I'm learning is the candor and the compassion and the bravery the three of you are showing in having this conversation with each other. Is we need more of that. I think part of the problem is like we don't get enough opportunities to talk with people from different walks of life in our own nation. So let's do a little bit more of that when we come back from the other side of this break. We're listening to Wisconsin voters about issues that matter to them and what they want for this country over the next 4 years. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Xinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are continuing our series of voter roundtables today. We're talking with Wisconsin voters about issues that matter to them and about what they hope for this country over the next 4 years, Wisconsin being a very key state for both the Trump and Biden campaigns. And we'll talk a little bit about how the campaigns have been how the members of the campaigns have been what they've been doing in Wisconsin over the past few days. We'll talk about that in a second. But next week, in the next installment of these voter roundtables, we will be turning to members of the United States military. So if you are a veteran or if you're currently serving, we want to hear from you. What qualities do you believe are most essential in a commander in chief? And what are your deepest hopes for the next 4 years for the country you serve? What do you think people need to understand about the U.S. military today? And what role do you think it plays or should play in protecting American democracy? So veterans and active duty service members, give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683 with your answers to those questions. Well, our Wisconsin voters who are joining us today are Randy Schmidt, Cassie Menina, and Alexis Arnold. And before we leave, sort of move forward to some other issues and questions, I did just want to ask all of you one last thing about race relations in this country. And that is, I heard you talking about, like, it's 2020. Why aren't race relations better in the United States? And I just wonder, I mean, this is where another aspect in which leadership really matters. So, Randy, let me just turn to you. I mean, I can't imagine it's helped at all that the president, frankly speaking, has very frequently either been overtly racist or used racist dog whistles, or, you know, every time he tweets about the suburbs, I think we all know what he's talking about. You can't see that as having helped.
No, and as long as we're going there with the Brown Lives Matter also, I mean, we have many Latino, Latinx workers on our farm, and, you know, the America eats because of that population. They do a lot of the production egg work. They work in a lot of the factories that produce food. So I'd rather, you know, why aren't we doing more to include them? I mean, they're doing the work. Why aren't they standing up and being counted? So that's the other side of the equation. You know, that's what I don't disagree with the current administration. We've talked about expanding the H-2A visas for farm workers and guest workers and things so that they will be recognized. And we're dropping the ball. And it hasn't been just, I'm not blaming Trump. This has been ongoing discussion since Reagan was in office and gave amnesty to many people, many, you know, Latinos back in 1980, you know. And why aren't we doing more to improve relations so we have a path to citizenship? This country needs a, our birth rates aren't increasing, so we do need to be the leader in this. We need people, and, you know, the only way we're going to get that is through immigration.
Yeah, well, this administration, I mean, Stephen Miller basically believes the exact opposite. It's pretty well documented he would prefer to bring immigration virtually down to zero. But Alexis and Cassie, did you want to chime in here?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting hearing, you know, Randy's perspective, because, you know, like you said, we know that a lot of, people helping on the farms, you know, are immigrants. And, you know, it's
not just the farms. I mean, they work in the factories that produce the food.
Yep.
They pick fresh produce. I mean, it's all the way up through the food chain.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're good, reliable workers.
Yeah. And, you know, and yeah, I agree. It's like, I think everyone deserves a chance, you know, people who are willing to work, who want to work. I mean, that's kind of what, you know, makes the United States so great, right? It's like, it gives you an opportunity to grow and excel and, you know, really go after those dreams, right? That whatever
they
are.
If you work, you become an active consumer. I mean, you're putting money in the economy. I mean, they're great spenders. I love it when our employees are driving new cars, or, you know, they're living you're seeing the American dream unfold through them. And I mean, I encourage that.
Randy, then I got to ask, and you're just going to have to forgive me. Then, I mean, in 2016, then candidate Donald Trump began his campaign by calling some of those very same immigrants that we're talking about right now, he called them murderers and rapists. I mean, that's how he started.
I agree. And yet, I still held hope. I mean, prior administrations haven't done anything on immigration. And, I mean, I'm looking at the guest worker visas and those type of things and an expansion of them. And if you look at, we have to, you know, I know that. But yet, it still doesn't, I'm not a one-issue candidate. You know, I have to look at the overall picture, but I think we can do better, and you know, he has talked about doing, when he's saying one thing, sometimes he's doing another thing. Mm. You know, he's talking about expansion of H-2A visas and such, that's as close as anybody's got in the last 20 years. Mm. And we have to get this right. I mean, as I said, we don't have an increasing birth rates in this country. And if we're going to maintain, that's what the advantage the other countries do have, is they have populations for manufacturing and stuff. We don't have that. So we're going to have to rely on immigration to some extent.
Yeah.
So why not, you know, give the voice to them and so they have a voice in our stand up and counted.
Mm-hmm. And Randy, just to, and
I know better when you say they're all rapists. Well, I've worked with, you know, the Latino population for 25 years, so I know better than that.
Okay, I'm glad you said that, because I just wanted to give you a chance to be clear that you weren't agreeing.
I know that's not the case.
Yeah, okay.
I've seen them involved in the community. I see how they live, and they're very, you know, religious and family oriented, and you know, sure, we have, that's, as we're going back to just, you know, when you're talking about a lot, it's a few, and that's what you hear about, but it's not the masses, you know.
Cassie, you've been quiet and patient here. What do you think?
Yeah, I think for me, one of the most frustrating things about President Trump for me is, you know, is this divisiveness that we're talking about. We've seen him frequently, you know, attack people of color. We've seen him attack women. We've seen him attack, you know, LGBTQ+ people. So for me, it's, when I see these things, it's hard to not see them as, or hard to not imagine them as personal, you know? So when we talk about these things, you know, how he has referred to immigrants in the past, how he's referred to women in the past, it's hard for me to see past that at times.
Alexis?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's hard for all of us to see past it. It's disappointing that, you know, we have a leader that speaks the way he does.
Right.
You know, and honestly, both of them, you know, right now, as we're heading, you know, so close to election, it's like, I don't know how else to, these are grown men, right? And they're both like attacking each other, and there's name calling. And it's just like, when are we going to move past that, right? With politics and, you know,
right.
And
let's,
I don't
get
know if
to the issues that really matter instead of all this other stuff. What about health care? We haven't went there. What about, I mean, these are all important issues. As I said, immigration, you know, we've talked about trade, but these are the issues that are we meeting? Who's going to meet the thing of it is, you know, who's going to meet our basic needs the best?
So let me ask a question to all three of you, because I think, again, for folks who have been paying attention to the campaigns for a while, they would say, well, they, you know, all the candidates have been talking about the issues and, you know, whatever their plans might be and their different visions, et cetera. So, like, is it that they're not talking about it in a way that's reaching you, or are you not hearing what you need? I mean, like, there seems to be a gap between all the effort and the many millions of dollars that are being spent to do this exact messaging versus what the three of you are saying you're hearing. So help me understand that.
I think today they said it was a billion. President Trump has raised $1 billion since he announced the re-election, and he's out of money already.
It'll definitely be $1 billion campaign season. We've had a couple of those so far, but like, is all this money like being like going up in smoke if you guys aren't hearing the policies or the discussions that you need to hear?
I mean, it feels like it. Yeah, it's, you know, obviously, you know, I was saying earlier, I'm probably the least political out of all of us right now that are on air. And, you know, because I am focusing on, I'm a single parent, you know, raising my daughter, you know, and also running a business. So I'm really focused on that. But, you know, when I have time to check in, whether it's picking up news that's coming in on my phone or stuff that's online, you know, I'm not seeing, like you said, you know, talks about education or talks about, you know, how we're going to help small business or healthcare, whatever those big ticket items are. It's like, oh, so-and-so said this, so-and-so said that. And it's just like this kind of bickering back and forth.
Uh-huh. Well, look, I mean, I definitely don't think that all of us who are members of this democracy, I should at all make our decisions based on those push notifications that come to our phones, right? Because it's never going to be enough. So maybe it's on all of us to like do a little bit more here. But listen, so we've just got about 5 minutes left here. And I want to hear a couple of things from all three of you. One is, as I've mentioned several times during this hour, the campaigns really are focused on Wisconsin. They see it as a must-win state, whether you're on the Biden camp or the Trump camp. You're going to be seeing those folks in the state a lot. Vice President Mike Pence and Senator Kamala Harris were there just over the weekend. Mm-hmm. Do you think that the Wisconsin they're seeing is, and Cassie, I'll just start with you, is the Wisconsin that you know? I mean, is what they're saying or the people they're talking to? Is that the Wisconsin that you know?
I mean, I guess. I think having, you know, Wisconsin kind of being brought up to this, you know, national news in the past couple weeks, I think that's provided a good opportunity for a lot of people from Wisconsin to, you know, kind of get their voice heard and like say what they're really thinking. So I think we are being accurately reflected that way by, you know, people who are choosing to stand up and say what they think.
Mm-hmm. And Randy and Alexis, what do you think?
Randy, you want to go?
Could you explain the question?
Yeah, it was a bit of a muddled question. I guess what I'm saying is that when campaigns visit places, right, it's all very scripted and structured. It's kind of theater. But they also are trying to reach voters directly. And the question is like when both Senator Harris and Vice President Pence both go to Kenosha, it's almost like they're speaking to two different Kenoshas, right? So how does that help you? Does it help you at all as a Wisconsin voter in terms of two things? One is, do the rest of us around the nation, are we getting a fair view of the state? And two, does it help you understand at all any better what these campaigns are about?
I mean, I don't really feel like it doesn't really help me. Like you said, like, I think it's just a weird election year. I also, you know, cause it seems like maybe, you know, Biden's camp isn't really out and about as much as they normally would be. But what's really interesting is Trump seems to be still just going about business as normal. So again, we have these two kind of very separate things that are happening because yes, we are still kind of dealing with COVID and everything. So we have our leader, you know, current leader that's like, oh, kind of acting like it's not a big deal, right? And we're seeing all these large groups together, but then it seems like Biden is a little bit more kind of still doing a lot of things remotely and, you know, video conference or whatever it is. So that's confusing as well, I think, for a lot of us, at least for me, because it's like, well, what's really going on, you know?
Well, we just got a couple of minutes left here, and every single thing that we've talked about, I could listen to the three of you sort of sort through it for hours on end, but we're headed towards the end of the show here. So let me just ask you, finally, something we've been asking every voter who's been on this show, which is, what do you want for this nation for the next 4 years? And Randy, I'll start with you.
I want to, we have to move through this present epidemic. I mean, we know that the world has changed. Our America and the world has changed forever right now. So I think we have to focus on how do we move through this, get people safety. I mean, meet their basic needs. And I mean, keep them fed, keep them sheltered and keep them safe.
Yeah.
And that's how are we going to get there? We have to keep pushing towards that.
And Alexis, you get about 30 seconds or so.
I mean, I definitely agree with Randy. It would just be really nice, and I don't know if, you know, we'll get to see, if I'll get to see this in my lifetime, to see somebody honest in office with good morals. You know what I mean, right? It is, it's laughable. But isn't that sad that it's laughable? You know, I think we all want a leader that we can look up to. Someone like we're proud to say, hey, this is our president. And it's just, that's not happening, you know?
That's not happening. You don't see a difference between the two candidates on just that issue alone?
Honestly, I don't. I don't really feel
we're not seeing anything from the
Oh, like we don't.
We haven't really. We're not seeing too much on any issue other than, you know, what we want meat and bones in Wisconsin. I mean, that's what we're about. We're meat and potato and meat and bone. Meat and potatoes is what, you know, that's what we want.
Right.
You know, so, and we're not seeing that from the Democratic candidates right now. I mean, all we're seeing is the fluff, I think.
Okay,
and,
well,
we know what Trump is.
I got to give Cassie the last word here because we're just about out of time. Cassie, your hopes for the next 4 years?
I think I agree with both Randy and Alexis. I think they both had great points. I think having a leader that reflected, you know, a greater majority of America, you know, from different backgrounds, different perspectives, I think that would be ideal. But I agree with a lot of what they had to say.
Well, Cassie Menonaw and Alexis Arnold and Randy Schmidt, thank you all so much for joining us today for this Wisconsin Roundtable. I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having
us.
Thank you.
Next week, again, we're going to be talking with members of the U.S. military in our next iteration of our weekly voter roundtable. So definitely stay tuned for that. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can profit motive save the planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.